Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. And I am saying that with a whole lot of a level of enthusiasm, primarily because I want to say congrats to my son, who will be graduating from high school this coming Sunday. It may not be the same kind of graduation that most of us experience, but he has completed all the requirements for high school. Sorry that he's going into the Marines, but that's his choice. He is probably following in his mother's footsteps. She was in the Marines, and so I guess that's what he wants to do too. In any event, congratulations, Gabriel. Gabriel U. Dean. Also, I'd like to congratulate my cousin Judge Mosley's son, Sean. Pretty soon it'll be Sean Mosley, not Judge Mosley's son. In any event, wonderful, bright, intelligent young man. Never disrespectful, always on point. Got married not so long ago. Very proud of him and all of his accomplishments. And being in an English department at Crosby High School is fantastic. Judge Mosley's son, Sean Mosley, is graduating from law school. Congratulations to Sean. I really appreciate having the opportunity to be able to see this thing happen. Today's show, by the way, is about somebody I had an opportunity to meet. Let's see, how many of you still remember Malcolm X? I met Malcolm in New Haven, Connecticut, of all places. He was over to a friend of mine's house who sang with the Five Satins, and he came over to talk. He was over the mosque there in New Haven, as well as the one in Boston. And to me, I thought he was sort of an imposing figure, not in terms of how he stood or how he looked or anything like that, but you could see the wheels turning in his head as he talked about his feelings about segregation and separation and all that good stuff. And even went into a whole bunch of other things of which I basically don't remember, because after listening to him for about 15 or 20 minutes, I just had enough and I just left. But one of the things that was so remarkable about this situation was, I think, maybe 7 or 8 years later, I had an opportunity. I was teaching at Springfield College. And one of the books that I had my class read was called The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Can you believe that? I had an opportunity to really get a chance to know somebody or meet somebody. I just mentally pushed him aside. But he went on to become one of our great leaders at the time. And so what we're going to do today is listen to some things about Malcolm X.
Malcolm X was born in America during the Jazz Age, a time of rampant racism, a time when African Americans were treated as second-class citizens and had few opportunities for advancement. Early in his short life, Malcolm worked at a variety of menial jobs, eventually turning to a life of crime. He spent years in prison. Then he converted to Islam and became a voice of hope for many African Americans even today. From criminal to charismatic leader, biography looks at the life of Malcolm X.
Malcolm became one of the lowest forms of human beings you could become, according to his own testimony in his autobiography. Before he reached his 21st birthday, he was locked up.
Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
We're talking about a guy who began his adult life as a hustler, doing every kind of drug available on the streets of Harlem, sexually promiscuous, a true sinner who purified himself through a religious conversion.
When they are being brutally and unjustly attacked, then the Negroes themselves should take whatever steps necessary to defend themselves.
Where is hope? You strike home to the crux of the matter. He hits you with the truth, just like someone would hit you in the head with a blunt instrument and butt your head open.
We must have separation in order to be equal. We must have separation in order to have freedom. We must have separation in order to have justice.
What is your real name?
Malcolm X.
Is that your legal name?
As far as I'm concerned, it's my legal name.
Would you mind telling me what your father's last name was?
My father didn't know his last name. The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today.
You mean you won't even tell me what your father's supposed last name was or gifted last name was?
I never acknowledged it whatsoever.
Although he did not acknowledge his given name in later life, he was born Malcolm Little on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska. He was the fourth child of Louise and Earl Little. Earl was from Georgia, Louise from Grenada. Earl, a Baptist minister, worked in construction to feed his growing family. Malcolm's childhood was heavily influenced by his parents' involvement in Marcus Garvey's Black Separatist Movement. Garvey preached that to survive, blacks must form their own nation outside the United States and separate from whites.
The Garvey Movement largely represented blacks who were not professionals, not largely lawyers and doctors, at least they were not prominent so much. They certainly reached down to get the masses of black people who were not in the mainstream, largely, of the African-American community.
The Ku Klux Klan was then powerful in the North. In Omaha, the Klan threatened the Littles before Malcolm was born because they were Garvey organizers. Rather than fight, Earl moved his family over the next 3 years, first to Milwaukee, then Indiana, finally settling in Lansing, Michigan in 1928. By then, Earl and Louise had four boys and a girl. Despite the dangers, Earl Little continued his work as a Garveyite.
He didn't have a permanent church, but he was a preacher. So he traveled from place to place, promoting Marcus Garvey movement, the separatist movement, and at the same time trying to preach the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He saw no conflicts between the two. Now, Malcolm used to travel with his father as he would talk about Garvey and talk in the churches about Jesus Christ. Malcolm learned to love the talk about Garvey, but he didn't like so much the talk about Jesus Christ.
Settling in the industrialized Midwest was a good idea at the time because Earl could find work. He and Louise had their hands full caring for their growing family. Malcolm's rivalry with his brothers was contentious at times as they competed for their parents' attention. Life was not easy for Malcolm and his family, but his father's hard work and preaching put enough food on the table. Then the Depression changed everything.
In Lansing, Detroit, Grand Rapids, places like that, the loss of jobs for African Americans was devastating. Chances are, if you were black, you were poor.
In 1929, their family home burned to the ground. Malcolm's father believed the Ku Klux Klan was responsible, but there was no proof. Earl Little built a new house, a tar paper shack with no running water, no indoor toilet. Earl gave each child daily chores, some in the garden, some in the house. He was a tough father, beating his children if they didn't follow his rules.
Malcolm's mother and father were violent in their relationship to each other. Malcolm talks about his father, you know, expressing the frustrations that he experienced in the society, in the context of the family. And that created a great deal of tension within the family. In fact, Malcolm claims that it was from the fight between his mother and his father that led his father to leave that day he was killed.
In 1931, when Malcolm was six, Earl Little died. He fell or was pushed off a streetcar in the middle of the night. His left arm was crushed and his left leg partially severed by the rear wheels. Although officials said the death was accidental, Malcolm believed his father had been killed by the Ku Klux Klan because of his separatist views. But Malcolm never talked publicly about his father's death.
This particular experience left the family destitute, and so Malcolm grew up in a very difficult situation in which he had very little reinforcement for his self-esteem in the environment in which he lived.
In the 1930s, none of the seven children had enough to eat. Stale bread, wild onions, and dandelion leaves were often the only food. At school, Malcolm ate alone, rarely joining the other kids for lunch.
For Malcolm, going to a predominantly white school, for example, feeling alienated from the dominant culture, feeling as if he really had very few friends and his white friends pretty much shunned him, that could have deep psychological effects on Malcolm.
He was tall, handsome, red-haired, light-skinned, different, even within his family.
Much of the color symbolism was reflected in the context of that family. Malcolm's mother was very light complexion. And so she, Malcolm's father, was a very dark complexion man. So the children were mixed. Some were dark, some were light. Malcolm was a light red, very much like his mother in color. So his mother was hard on him. She wanted Malcolm to get in the sun and put some black on him.
Malcolm became a troublesome child after his father's death. His mother found it hard to supervise her family alone. Though Malcolm was a good student, he became a disciplinary problem, and he was moved from school to school. But despite all that, in the seventh grade, he was voted class president. Years later, Malcolm realized this was his first experience with tokenism.
Being the only African American, or one of the few, also makes you an exotic. He did get a lot of attention, and people noticed him where he went. It was also an unusual situation to be not only young, black, poor, even if it's down in the white community, but to be as intelligent and as articulate as he was, which made him, in some respects, an automatic leader, even among his peers.
Because his teachers found him so hard to handle, in the eighth grade, Malcolm was placed in a white foster home in Mason, Michigan. The authorities thought new surroundings would calm him. Soon he was first in his class, but his desire to achieve, to be somebody, quickly faded.
In fact, when he was in the eighth grade, the incident that forced him to drop out of school, embarrassed him, made him feel like he was not important, was when his teacher asked him what he wanted to be when he would grow up. And he said he wanted to be a lawyer, an attorney. And his teacher said to him, Malcolm, you have to be a little more realistic than that, because you can't be that and a nigger at the same time. Being a lawyer is no realistic expectation for a nigger, he said.
He became disheartened and quit school. Malcolm was 14. It was the eve of World War II. Though the Depression was ending, life was still hard in America, especially for blacks. Malcolm's mother, Louise, was pregnant with her eighth child. The father was unknown. She was increasingly losing touch with reality. After her son was born, she was found wandering in the cold of winter, her feet bare, her baby boy held tightly in her arms. Louise was declared legally insane and committed to Kalamazoo State Hospital. Malcolm now had neither mother nor father to guide him.
He could not be just like the white children. and thus being shown in many ways that he could not be accepted just like anybody else. And this tension grew in Malcolm so much so that he dropped out of the dominant society.
School had no meaning for Malcolm. Teachers could not discipline him. He sometimes stole. But something new was on the horizon. His half-sister Ella, a daughter from Earl Little's first marriage, came from Boston to visit the family. After she returned home, she asked Malcolm to stay with her over the summer. She knew her half-brother was having a difficult time and took it on herself to save him. But Boston opened Malcolm's eyes.
Boston was the big city, and he was treated by his peers immediately as a kind of country bumpkin, backwards, young. And one way to escape that country baggage was to enter a kind of cool subculture, in this case, of the Zoot Suit, of the hipster, a kind of underground, predominantly male youth culture that was raging in the late 30s and early 40s.
After the summer, Malcolm returned to Lansing, where his family was still struggling to survive. He felt isolated and sent Ella a letter saying he wanted to live in Boston. She told him he was welcome. By February 1941, he was back in a city that would change his life forever. After the death of his father, his mother's confinement in an insane asylum, and his increasing loneliness as one of the few blacks in East Lansing, 15-year-old Malcolm was anxious to return to the predominantly black Roxbury section of Boston. Once there, he gave his sister Ella more problems than she could handle.
She didn't run around the streets looking for it. You know, because he came to Boston, you know, like he was a country boy. And he, of course, had to do a lot of ducking and dodging because there were a lot of relatives who lived in Boston at that time. And he just became completely dazzled by everything and wanted to get out there.
Malcolm wanted to be like the blacks at the man's hall, the ballroom hall. He wanted to be like the blacks who were not ashamed of who they were and who lived in the underworld. And he became a part of it.
When you go to a place like the Rosen Ballroom, for example, they were packed full of young people, men dressed in suits, young women who could identify with the hipster culture.
Malcolm bought a colorful zoot suit. Then he took the painful, fashionable step of conking his hair, straightening it using rye, raw potatoes, and eggs. He was starting a new life. Though Ella wanted him to be a lawyer to go into business, Malcolm's thoughts were elsewhere. After years as an outsider, Malcolm had finally found a place where he belonged.
They embraced him because he was articulate. They embraced him because he ended up being a very good dancer. He was stylish. He was able to put on a suit of clothes and look like a changed person, a brand new person, and step out of his background and into kind of a whole new world.
Part of that world was the inner sanctum of the pool hall, the hangout of hustlers, hipsters, budding crooks, and small-time criminals.
I used to play pool in this pool room every day. And Malcolm had a reputation in Roxbury at that time of being one of the best-dressed men in town with the famous zoot suit. And he was standing on the sidelines watching the fellas shoot pool.
One day in the pool hall, Shorty Jarvis made a great shot and in the excitement lost his watch.
And I looked at Malcolm and said, "You didn't see it, did you?" Because he was a newcomer. And he had a smirk on his face. And I walked up to him quick with my hands in those days, grabbed him and drew back the lid. So when I did, somebody grabbed my head up and said to me, "No, he didn't take your watch. Somebody else got your watch and they're gone." Now I was in the process of apologizing to him, straightening out his shirt, "Man, I'm sorry, I falsely accused you," and so on, so on. That was the beginning of our friendship.
Despite the fancy clothes, to survive, Malcolm had to take what he called slave jobs, menial work open to blacks. He worked as a kitchen porter on the New Haven Railroad. bussed tables, swept floors. In nightclubs, where he met the big entertainers of the day, Malcolm shined shoes. The jobs gave him money to eat, leaving him time to develop his skills as a petty criminal.
Malcolm was, in my opinion, a beautiful con artist. He was a thinker. And he learned these things from street smarts, I call it, from living on the streets and being around people in the Husband War. He could meet you on the street, as I've told you many times, and be broke, and talk you out of your last $2, and you'd give it to him with enthusiasm.
Working on the railroad allowed Malcolm to travel freely and often between Boston and Harlem, New York.
Harlem was the capital, and that was the mystical culture, the capital of the black world. And so going to Harlem for Malcolm was like going to Harlem for a lot of African Americans. It was entering the most exciting place you can possibly be.
Malcolm, already part of Boston's subculture, became part of Harlem's thriving underground economy. He moved into pimping, steering white men to black prostitutes. During World War II, Malcolm was a petty stick-up man, ran numbers, sold marijuana. He frequented jazz clubs with a small-time pusher and used every drug he could find.
Clubs where jazz was performed were places of exchange for drug dealers and music. And so the whole world that surrounded Malcolm was also one infested with drugs. And so it was hard for him to escape that possibility.
In spite of the lure of Harlem, Malcolm always returned to Boston, to Roxbury, where he was admired for his flashy clothes and his charismatic personality.
He was like a Romeo. And I say that the girls were all after him. He was the type of person that when he walked down the street, he would command attention. With that blood-red hair he had, and with that zoot suit on, the girls were all in love with him.
During Christmas 1945, Malcolm, in constant need of new thrills, went on a spur-of-the-moment robbery spree in Cambridge with Jarvis and three white women, one of whom was Malcolm's girlfriend.
We were out there for 2 weeks for a fun kit. Somebody in the gang said, oh, let's go out and break in somebody's house for fun. Being adventurous, as young people like to be. We certainly wasn't doing it for money. We were making our own livelihoods in our own rights. So for fun for 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks, we stopped.
Malcolm was eventually arrested when he attempted to buy back a watch he had pawned. The gang was caught, indicted, and tried in early 1946. Malcolm and Shorty could not make bail and were kept in a cage inside the courtroom. Jarvis said the detectives and prosecution were furious that white girls were socializing with black men.
They tried to get the girls to say that we had raped them. The girls wouldn't hear that because they knew better. They sentenced the girls to 5 years in a reformatory and gave them a suspended sentence and set them free.
But Malcolm Little, not yet 21, and Malcolm Jarvis were given up to 10 years in prison.
We were not hardened criminals. We didn't feel that we deserved that kind of time as first offenders. So we were given that time mostly because of our associating with white girls.
It was very difficult for Malcolm not to be put in jail and not to get in trouble with the law because of the context of the world in which he was living. And it was in prison that his life was transformed.
In jail, Malcolm made a pact with Jarvis that they would learn everything they could and not come out, in Jarvis's words, as stupid and dumb as we went in. Life in prison was like nothing they had ever known.
The cell you lived in was 6x12. You had a hard cloth to lay on, one table, one small stool, a bucket of water, no running water, and a bucket for defecation. It was unsanitary, unclean, and filthy.
So with years of time on their hands, The two friends sat, studied, and read long into the night until their eyes burned. Malcolm educated himself, sharpening his skills as a debater and speaker. While he was in prison, Malcolm's brothers, Wilford and Filbert, had become members of the Nation of Islam, a small black separatist movement in Detroit led by Elijah Muhammad, a one-time follower of Marcus Garvey. Malcolm's brothers urged him to convert, saying they found in religion a way of life that offered survival. At first, Malcolm resisted. Then he relented. His life was transformed.
He saw Christianity as the white man's religion, as the religion of black people who wanted to become like white people. But here in the black Muslim, the Nation of Islam, he encountered a religion that reinforced his identity as a black person and enabled himself to love himself as a black person.
He didn't have a particular love for white people. And they used to call him Satan at one time because they thought he was evil. Not of the white inmates, especially, used to call him that.
In 1952, after 6.5 years in prison, Malcolm Little was released on parole wearing a $10 suit. He moved to Michigan to be with his older brother, Wilford. In Detroit, he would once again transform himself. After 6.5 years in prison, Malcolm was released in August 1952. He went to Detroit, where his brother, Wilford, found him a construction job. He joined the Nation of Islam's mosque. He worked hard to gain acceptance, to earn his X, his new name for his new life as a black Muslim, to replace the slave name imposed on his forefathers. Malcolm soon went to Chicago, the headquarters of the Nation of Islam, where he met with Elijah Muhammad and officially became Malcolm X. His religious conversion was complete.
It is an about-face, a complete turnaround, a totally new life in which Malcolm, who was the criminal, now becomes a minister in the religion of Islam.
When Malcolm came out of prison, the Nation of Islam was a quite isolated little sect of about 400, so he would tell Muhammad, you've got to bring this message to a much larger audience.
So he became a recruiter, one who went out and fished, as he said, for others to become a part of the Nation of Islam.
The Negro would be serving notice that no longer does he believe in turning the other cheek and being a constant victim of someone else's brutality.
The message of Elijah Muhammad was clear. The Nation of Islam did not need white people or white society. Black self-esteem came first, and with it, the establishment of a separate country inside the United States for blacks alone. Failing that, blacks should be allowed to return to their African homeland.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We are not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
The message was always, this is a racist society. White folks are not going to rescue you. Forget about the civil rights movement. Forget about the civil rights legislation.
You will never get real freedom and recognition between black and white people in this country without destroying the country.
It was a message that terrified white America and was too extreme for most black Americans who saw the more moderate civil rights movement growing. In 1954, in Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court said public schools must be integrated. In 1955, Rosa Parks started the Montgomery bus boycott by refusing to move to the back of the bus. Martin Luther King Jr., at 26, began his rise as a leader in the push toward integration.
The Negro citizens of Montgomery, Alabama, will return to the buses on a non-segregated basis.
Meanwhile, the Nation of Islam struggled to win converts.
Malcolm became the chief evangelist for the Nation of Islam, and he would go from city to city with great success.
As a reward, Elijah appointed Malcolm head of Temple 7 in New York, and he became the national representative for the Nation of Islam.
And is regarded very highly as the number two person in the Nation of Islam. And it will be being regarded as the number two person that will eventually lead to all kinds of jealousy within the movement.
Elijah regarded Malcolm as a son and told him he should marry for the good of the movement. In January 1958, at age 32, Malcolm wed Betty Saunders, who had gone to college and was planning to become a nurse. They moved to a small house in East Elmhurst, Queens, owned by the Nation of Islam. In November of that year, Atala, the first of their six daughters, was born. Malcolm was a caring father, a good husband, but he was almost never home. His missionary work and message came first. Blacks have been deprived for hundreds of years. It's time to take a stand.
In the areas of the country where the government has proven itself unable and, or unwilling to defend the Negroes when they are being brutally and unjustly attacked, then the Negroes themselves should take whatever steps necessary to defend themselves.
Because of Malcolm's efforts and his personal charisma, the movement was growing fast.
Malcolm was very easy to grab hold to because Malcolm was John Wayne. Malcolm was all the things in the movie that we saw about our heroes. Our heroes didn't take nothing from nobody, and they always had the best lines. Tall, lean, handsome, magnetic, a brilliant smile, a dazzling smile.
Malcolm was everywhere. He debated on college campuses, made speeches on street corners, appeared on radio and television. The more Malcolm saw of America, the more his philosophy began to change.
For Elijah Muhammad, the movement was strictly religious. Allah would be the one that would punish the white devil. Malcolm, however, did not want to wait on God.
It was the start of the rift between Malcolm and the Nation of Islam. But there was something on the horizon that would widen the split further. Malcolm discovered that Elijah might have fathered as many as 8 illegitimate children. He thought if the story got out, it could seriously hurt the movement. He called fellow ministers he trusted to warn them of the danger.
All 3 of the people he told immediately blew the whistle on him, called headquarters in Chicago and said, Malcolm is blaspheming against the messenger. He was the object of a lot of jealousy, so I think those people were motivated partly by jealousy. One of them was Louis Farrakhan.
Malcolm's finding out that Elijah Muhammad was actually the biggest hypocrite of all was quite devastating to him. It took the very foundation upon which he was standing out from under his feet.
His access to Elijah became limited. He was rarely quoted in Muhammad Speaks, the newspaper he created. But despite his problems, Malcolm continued preaching the gospel of the Nation of Islam.
It was a chance to solve our own problem among ourselves on some land of our own, instead of continually trying to force us into white society, where the white society knows we're absolutely not wanted.
Now, Malcolm did not see how you could get freedom for African Americans by trying to be like white people. He did not see that whites would ever accept us fully as human beings. So for him, he didn't see why it is that the civil rights movement fought so hard to be integrated at the lunch counter for a cup of coffee, because he felt that a cup of coffee was a small price to pay for 250 years of slavery.
As the civil rights movement gained momentum, the Nation of Islam remained on the sidelines, unyielding in its dreams of separatism. Though Malcolm kept his religious faith, he was moving further toward political activism and inevitably toward a greater confrontation with Elijah Muhammad. Though Malcolm's differences with the Nation of Islam were widening, it was not apparent to outsiders. He was as uncompromising and faithful as ever.
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that the only solution for the problem is that our people, of which there are now 22 million, be involved in mass exodus back to their own homelands.
Despite adhering to the party line, Malcolm became increasingly isolated from Elijah Muhammad and his inner circle. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, gave the Nation of Islam a way to limit Malcolm's growing influence.
Elijah Muhammad did not want anybody talking about the death of Kennedy, the reason being that he was a beloved figure not only in white America, but in black America.
On December 1st, Malcolm gave a standard speech, but in an unusual departure, he took questions, and his first one was about Kennedy's death.
He said it was a case of the chickens coming home to roost. Was exactly what he shouldn't have said in terms of his relations with Elijah Muhammad. So he had handled his enemies a sword.
Elijah Muhammad knew that silence was his best weapon against Malcolm. He suspended him for 3 months. In January 1964, Malcolm had a secret meeting with Elijah in Phoenix and learned he had no chance for reinstatement. His ideas for the Nation of Islam had become too threatening to Elijah Muhammad's power structure.
They didn't want Malcolm to succeed Elijah Muhammad as the leader of the movement. And the best way to do that was to make sure that Malcolm was marginalized and expelled.
And worse, Malcolm began to receive death threats by telephone, by letter, and on the street. In March 1964, after 3 months of silence and much soul-searching, Malcolm quit the Nation of Islam to form his own organization, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated.
He was to join the civil rights movement, to broaden its scope, so as to make it much more militant, infuse some militancy in it.
Malcolm brought his new message everywhere with renewed energy. In Washington, during a hearing on civil rights, he accidentally met Martin Luther King Jr. for the only time. The two men merely exchanged greetings. In April, Malcolm delivered a major speech defining his new activism.
The ballot is as powerful as the book. At least they're both in book. And if you don't use the ballot, you're going to have to use the book.
The Nation of Islam, continuing its purge of Malcolm, filed an eviction notice ordering Betty and their daughters to vacate their home. Malcolm and his family did not leave. Soon afterwards, his sense of religious mission drew him to a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a pilgrimage to Mecca. It was a journey that would fundamentally change him.
I didn't see any racism. I didn't see any conflict between the people over there because of the colors of their skin, or the differences in color of skin.
Many in America wanted to believe that Malcolm had modified his extremist views.
What most whites wanted Malcolm to say and to do was to act as if racism had been eliminated, and therefore I like all white people. And Malcolm could never say that.
In 1964, Malcolm formed the Organization of Afro-American Unity, created to reach out to blacks throughout the world as an expression of brotherhood.
Unlike the other leaders of that time, Malcolm X had a foreign policy. He was treated in Africa when he traveled around almost like he was the Secretary of State, you know, from black folks in America to the rest of the world.
But to the American government, Malcolm was seen as a revolutionary.
Malcolm was a haunted man. And a hunted man. Agents of the American government, both of the State Department and the CIA, were monitoring his movements around Africa. He gets home and the climate is tenderly hot.
Inflammatory articles against Malcolm appear frequently in the Nation of Islam newspaper, Muhammad Speaks.
The most notorious was one written by Louis Farrakhan and Louis X, who had been a protege of Malcolm's. Malcolm himself described it as as a death warrant.
In December 1964 and into January 1965, the threats continued. There were even several attempts on his life, assumed by some to be inspired by the Nation of Islam.
I said, if you think for one moment that these brothers are not going to try to take you out, you're mistaken.
But he knew he was hunted, and he knew his days were numbered, I think.
In the early morning hours of February 14, 1965, his home was firebombed and destroyed.
Except for a lucky stroke of fate, he and his family, including four quite small children and his wife, who was pregnant with twins, would have died.
I really think now he's going to die. I mean, he knew he was going to be killed. I knew he was going to be killed.
Malcolm moved his family and continued his mission, making speeches in Detroit and New York. In the week following the firebombing, observers described him as being very tense. On Saturday, February 20th, the day before he was to make a speech at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, he checked into the Hilton Hotel in Manhattan.
I think he enjoyed the luxuries. He used to kid about it. He'd say, now I know what white folks have been hiding from us all these years.
Despite his going into hiding, threatening calls to his home and the hotel did not stop. Sunday morning, Malcolm phoned Dick Gregory in Chicago, wondering if he would be there for the speech.
And Malcolm sounded kind of sad, but Malcolm knew something was going to happen. You know? And then I said, I love you. And I would have liked to see him when I get back, but I knew that.
Before the speech, Malcolm was making plans for a trip south later that week.
I went backstage and I was talking to him. And I remember thinking for the first time that he really looked harried.
He got stuck at a lectern, does the traditional Muslim greeting.
I heard him say, As-salamu alaykum.
Somebody leaps up and says, nigga, get your hands out of my pockets.
And then the next thing I heard was the shots. And when I heard the shots, I jumped up and I ran through the doors into the main room. And I, you know, it sounded to me like literally hundreds of shots.
The first blast killed him. Really was chest.
And I heard, you know, people screaming and getting knocked down. And I got knocked down on the floor.
Two more guys come up, one with a Luger and one, I believe, with a 45. And pump bullets into his dead body, his dying body.
So I lay on the floor until I heard the shooting stop, then I jumped up and I ran down and I jumped on stage. And I saw him, you know, laying there on stage, someone had pulled his shirt open and I saw the bullet hold to his body.
At 39 years of age, on Sunday, February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated by three men, all members of the Nation of Islam.
He died for what he believed in. He believed with his whole heart, soul, and mind in the struggle of the Afro-Americans in this country.
1 week later, thousands would attend Malcolm X's funeral in Harlem. People were stunned by his death. Black America had lost a powerful leader. Born into a life of struggle and uncertainty, Malcolm X lived as a hustler and pimp, then as a fighter for his people, and finally, a man of God. But the controversy sparked by his death would ensure that Malcolm X would not easily be forgotten. Malcolm X was laid to rest in Hartsdale, New York, on February 27, 1965. Throughout his life, he remained uncompromising in his expectations for African Americans. For 30 years, the legacy of Malcolm X has been as much a source of controversy as the circumstances surrounding his death. In 1995, the passions and doubts that have smoldered since that time were rekindled.
Ever since the black leader Malcolm X was assassinated 3 decades ago, his family has been convinced that the Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan was involved. Farrakhan was certainly a bitter rival, and today one of Malcolm X's daughters has been arrested and accused of trying to arrange for Mr. Farrakhan to be murdered.
In 1965, Kavila Shabazz was 4 years old. She was in the Audubon Ballroom with her mother and 3 sisters only a few feet away when assassins gunned down her father. 30 years later, she has been tied to a conspiracy to murder Louis Farrakhan, the man who was her father's great rival in the Nation of Islam. Despite his violent opposition to Malcolm's break with Elijah Muhammad, Farrakhan has denied any involvement in the murder of Malcolm X.
No, I was not in any way involved in his murder. I said such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death, and worthy it not for Elijah Muhammad's faith in God, it would have been so. I was very angry with Malcolm for what Malcolm had done. I was hurt by his assassination. I can't say that I approved, and I really didn't disapprove. I was numb.
The charges against Kabila Shabazz set off a bizarre series of accusations, conspiracy theories, and shifting alliances.
Lawyers for both Ms. Shabazz and Mr. Farrakhan charged that a government informant lured her into the plot. Although Shabazz did not plead guilty, she also admitted that a statement she made last December, where she said killing Farrakhan was her idea, was substantially true. But outside of court, she disavowed the confession.
But it was coerced.
It was not. Now, instead of going on trial on charges that carried a prison term of up to 90 years, Shabazz is getting what amounts to 2 years probation.
The surreal sequence of events culminated less than 1 week after the hearing, when once passionate enemies stood as apparent allies.
At New York's Apollo Theater last night, Betty Shabazz, the widow of Malcolm X and Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, tried to make amends after a 30-year rift. At a fundraiser hosted by Farrakhan to benefit her family, Mrs. Shabazz thanked her husband's one-time enemy for his support.
It is an uneasy truce, but it is a measure of the impact Malcolm X had that 3 decades later, his death and his legacy are still capable of stirring powerful emotions.
What did he mean when he was golden? You know, I said, he left changed minds. And that's the most lasting thing.
He was a field general in the movement. And he was loved for that. And he will be loved for a long, long time for his ethics and for his integrity. The goal he had in mind was to teach our people to rise up in this world, to defeat racism anywhere it rears its ugly head.
My personal problem is never solved as long as the problem is not solved for all of our people in this country. So I remain Malcolm X as long as there is a need to protest and struggle and fight against the injustices that our people are involved in this country.
Well, that was Malcolm X's big bibliography. And there were a lot of notables that spoke about him, and Dick Gregory was one of those ones that you probably heard. There was the last one talking about him. Well, I have some time left, and so I thought it might be appropriate for you to hear Malcolm without all of the other stuff, fanfare and other kinds of statements that are being made about him. But let me introduce you to him. And when we can conclude this, then I will say a few words about what we are experiencing here in our society today.
Why aren't you the landlord? Yes, you. Why aren't you the landlord? Every day you go to... to the Negro race. Headquarters of the Muslim movement is here in Chicago in the 5300 block of South Greenwood, and his leader now is known as Elijah Muhammad. He's in residence here. The most active person in the spreading of the black Muslim movement is Elijah Muhammad's second in command, who calls himself Malcolm X. And Malcolm X is our guest today on City Desk. Across the desk, our panelists this week are NBC newsmen Charles McCune, Floyd Calver, Len O'Connor. And Mr. X, may I begin by asking you, if you will please, outlines for us the platform and policies of the Muslim organization.
Well, the platform that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, our religious leader, stands upon is the platform of complete freedom, justice, and equality for the 20 million black people, or so-called Negroes here in America. And he teaches us that because of the seriousness of the condition that our people now find themselves in, that it's absolutely impossible to solve our problems with means other than religion. And he teaches us that the religion of Islam is the only religion that will instill within our people the incentive to stand on our own feet. And instead of trying to force ourselves upon whites or force ourselves into the white society or blame the white man for our predicament and constantly beg him for what he has, he says that the only way that we can solve our problem is to unite together among ourselves, among our own kind, clean ourselves up, rid ourselves of the evils that we've become addicted to here in this society, and try and solve our problem ourselves.
And I referred to the popular belief that the Muslims preach a hatred for the white race. You do not subscribe to this?
No. I've never heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teach or preach hatred for anyone. He preaches hatred against evil, against drunkenness, against dope addiction, against poverty, and against having to beg for the things that a man is supposed to have. But I've never heard him teach us or any of his followers hatred toward any human being.
Do you think that some of his followers possibly then have misinterpreted the word that they've heard and follow a practice of hatred for the white race?
I don't think that any Muslim practices hatred toward anyone. We have businesses around the country that are patronized by whites, and we have many businesses here in Chicago, and our customers are white as well as our own kind. And a white person can go into any of these places of business, and he'll have to admit that he is treated with more respect, and he finds more dignity there than he will find among the so-called Negroes who profess to be teaching love for everyone.
You've had twice you referred to the Negroes, the so-called Negroes. You find some fault with this.
Yes. Mr. Muhammad teaches us that Negro is a term that was applied to us during slavery by the slave master. And right today, it's a term that is used only to point out the descendant of slaves. It's never used for black people, period. Africans can come to this country. They aren't called Negroes. And if they are called Negroes, they resent it. So if Negro meant black, as we've been taught, it would be a term that would be applicable to or applicable to everyone. But he says that it is something that means a slave or something who is, it means something that has been left out of society, politically, economically, educationally, and otherwise.
You don't think of it as an anthropological term?
Definitely. It's not an anthropological term. It's a slave term. And it was a term that was invented in America and was used by the slave makers, slave traders, and slave masters, and attached to the property or the chattel or merchandise that our people represented in that particular day.
Mr. O'Connor,
what is your real name? Malcolm. Malcolm X.
Is that your legal name?
As far as I'm concerned, it's my legal name.
Have you been to court to establish
the I didn't have to go to court to be called Murphy or Jones or Smith. Excuse me for answering you this way.
That's all right.
A Chinese person were to say his name was Patrick Murphy, you would look at him like he's insane, because Murphy is an Irish name, a European name, or the name that has a Caucasian or a white background. And a yellow person, Chinese is a yellow man, and he has nothing to do or no connection whatsoever with the name Murphy. And if it doesn't look proper for a person who is yellow or Chinese to be walking around named Murphy or Jones or Johnson or Bunch or Powell, I think it would be just as improper for a black person or the so-called Negro in this country, as we're taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to walk around with these names. And therefore, he teaches us that during slavery, the same slave master who owned us put his last name on us to denote that we were his property. So that when you see a Negro today who's named Johnson, if you go back in his history, you'll find that he was once his grandfather or one of his forefathers was owned by a white man who was named Johnson. His name is Bunch. His grandfather was owned by a white man that was named Bunch.
Would you mind telling me what your father's last name was?
My father didn't know his last name. My father got his last name from his grandfather, and his grandfather got it from his grandfather, who got it from the slave master. the real names of our people were destroyed.
Well, was there any line, any point in the genealogy of your family when you did have to use the last name? And if so, what was it?
The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today.
You mean you won't even tell me what your father's supposed last name was or gifted last name was?
I never acknowledge it whatsoever.
Let me ask you about the status of Elijah Muhammad. First of all, is he ill?
I spoke to him today. He's in better health than he has been. He's suffering from asthmatic bronchitis.
Is that why he didn't attend your rally on last Tuesday?
The only reason that he didn't attend was his ill condition, and the weather here, especially on that particular day, was of such nature that it would have been almost insane for him to come.
Well, now, did you hold that meeting last Tuesday because it coincided with the general election, the primary election?
I think if you study the history of Mr. Muhammad's work and religious work in this country, we've had our convention on February the 26th every year for, I think, the past 33 years.
Well, now, while you don't care to discuss your former name or the name that the slave master gave to your antecedents, it is a matter of record that Muhammad's last name was Poole, Elijah Poole.
No, that's the name that his slave master gave to his grandfather or great-grandfather, but that's not his name.
Well, his mother and father thought when they called him Elijah Poole that that was his name.
They didn't know any better.
Well, if they didn't know any better or not, they thought that was his name.
Yes, sir, but sir...
What I'm trying to find out is when did he cease to be Elijah Poole and get to be Elijah Muhammad?
In 1931, I think it was, in Detroit, he was taught the true history of our people and made aware at that time that he was wearing an English name, and by not being an Englishman, he looked out of place. And his teacher gave him the name that he's wearing today, Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad.
All right, now when did he become what he purports to be in your literature, the son of Allah?
I've never heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad referred to as the son
the
of Allah.
The prophet of Allah.
I've never heard him referred to as the prophet of Allah.
What do you refer to him?
Messenger of Allah.
All right, the messenger of Allah, and I... appreciate the correction.
Yes, I mean, he says that a prophet is somebody who predicts the future, and he's not predicting the future, whereas a messenger is someone who carries a message that has been given to him by one who authors that message.
Well, now, who gave him the message, and to whom is it supposed to be delivered?
Master W.F. Muhammad, the one who taught him, is the author of the message. He gave it to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which makes him the messenger, and he's to deliver that message of truth and righteousness to the 20 million American so-called Negroes, which means he's to teach us the truth, which will awaken us, and then show us how to live a life of righteousness, which will automatically qualify us for recognition as human beings by all other righteous human beings here on this earth.
Well, now, one other question. With reference to what Mr. Herbert asked you a little bit ago, you took a very moderate position of wanting independence without having any hatred for the whites. Do I understand that correctly?
Hatred is not involved in it whatsoever.
Well, I recall in a recent plane crash, I mean two or three years ago, or less than that, a charter flight on Air France in which a group of people from Atlanta, Georgia, were, as they say, in the business, as they took off from Arley Field, and you were quoted at that time as expressing great gratification that this tragedy had occurred. Do you recall that?
I recall it.
What did you say? Do you remember?
The press misinterpreted it and misrepresented it.
What did you say?
They said that it was made at a Muslim meeting. It wasn't. It was made at a rally of Negroes, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, and otherwise in Los Angeles, who were rallying to protest the brutal shooting of seven unarmed Negroes
by
heavily armed white policemen in the city of Los Angeles. And because we are a people who have been taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to never carry weapons of any kind, but to get on God's side and rely on God to fight our battles for us, at the time that these brothers were shot down so brutally, I pointed out at the funeral of the brother who died that God would step in and take a hand in giving us some form of justice for the brutal killing of our brother. And when the plane crashed in France, I pointed out to the crowd at this rally that this was an act of God showing his wrath or complete resentment over the brutal form of injustice that had been inflicted upon our poor unarmed brothers.
Will you say that or do you believe that?
At that time, Dr. Billy Graham was at a crusade in Chicago, and the press, your papers here in this city, quoted Billy Graham of also saying that that plane crash was an act of God. And if you take time to check the newspapers, I think that you'll find that this is correct. But no one thought that Billy Graham was so wrong when he attributed the crash of this plane to his God. But when we say that it come from our God, then we're looked upon as being, outrageous.
I know, but you took the position that this was a matter of satisfaction to you for an injustice done against you, and I think that that's a trifle severe.
We did not think that it was a coincidence that 120 of the whites on this plane came from the state of Georgia, a state that has the worst record in the history of America for the mistreatment of black people in this country.
Worse than Mississippi?
They maybe are a little less Mississippi is a little less hypocritical today than Georgia, but both of them are still practicing the same thing. Now the whites in Georgia bite Negroes with a smile, whereas they used to bite them with a growl. But they're still being bitten, and we don't think that it is any worse to be bitten with a smile than just to be bitten with a growl.
Mr. Calvert,
while we're on the subject of Mississippi, what is your organization's position of what happened in Mississippi in the past?
Such as what?
Such as the James Meredith incident and the enrollment of him in the university.
Well, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wants justice for every one of the 20 million so-called Negroes. And to just take one Negro and stick him in college with the aid of $15,000 troops and at a cost of $6,000 is a disgrace. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's a farce. It's hypocrisy. Because if it's right for one Negro to be forced into that university, then every Negro in the state of Mississippi who is qualified has the same right to go to that university. And if the government is not ready and willing to enforce the right of every Negro in the state of Mississippi, then, in my opinion, sir, it's only hypocrisy to pretend that they are for justice by pushing one Negro in and blowing it up all over the world to make it look like they're solving the problem when millions of black people in that state are still going to segregate the schools and getting an inferior education.
Does your organization encourage members to attempt to enter schools that have been known as all white?
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad doesn't discourage us from attending white schools, but he does say that it is bad for us to go to our own schools. And after we have a thorough knowledge of ourselves, of our own kind, and racial dignity has been instilled within us, then we can go to anyone's school and we'll still retain our race pride, our racial dignity, and we will be able to avoid the subservient inferiority complex that most Negroes have or are, that is instilled within most Negroes who receive this sort of integrated education.
Well, you have a private school operating here in Chicago, at least, and possibly elsewhere. And it's been a subject of controversy lately. What is the acceptance of people who come out of your private schools into schools of higher learning?
Yes, we have many students who have graduated from the University of Islam on 54th and Greenwood that are now attending other schools. In fact, just as an example, one of Mr. Muhammad's sons never attended any school in his life but the University of Islam. He later attended DePaul University. He also attended the University of Chicago, and at present he's attending Al-Azhar University in Cairo, one of the oldest Muslim schools in the world. And his daughter-in-law also, who went to school here, is attending the University of Cairo. And then we have other students who have graduated that are attending other colleges and universities in this country. And in our school, we never have any delinquency problems. We never have any dropouts. We never have any disrespect for authority or disrespect for parents. We don't have any kind of juvenile delinquency. All of the things that the regular school system is complaining about, the critics and the most severe critics of Mr. Muhammad has to admit that we aren't plagued with those same problems in our own school.
I have listened to your leader, at least on one occasion in a convention here. It was 2 years ago, and at that time he advocated the separate state proposition of giving the what you call the so-called American Negro a separate state in which to live, to make their own way. Would you explain that philosophy, please? And have you had any support for it from anybody in official ranks?
First question first. To my understanding, what Mr. Muhammad has said is that he wants showing equality for the black people here in America, which you agree they don't have. If they did, you wouldn't have a race problem. And he says, if America cannot bring about freedom, justice, and equality for our people in this country, then America should allow us to leave. If we can't get along together, we should be allowed to depart and go someplace where we can set up housekeeping for ourselves. Then he says, if America doesn't want us to go back home among our own people, and at the same time they want to keep us here, since we can't stay here and get along together in peace, he says what America should do is separate part of the country and give us a section where we can live and give us everything we need to get our particular section functioning independently, support us for 25 years until we are able to function independently in a society of our own, and in this way, the problem will be solved.
Mr. McKeown,
you say there's no juvenile delinquency. What is the discipline that...
Well, number one, excuse me,
practice.
One of the first things that Mr. Muhammad teaches is you have to set an example if you want others to do right. And he teaches the grown-up Muslims to live a highly disciplined and a highly moral, a life of high morals. And by the parents displaying the highest of morals in front of the children at all times, automatically this sets a pattern or an example for the children. And in our schools, our children, the emphasis is placed upon the recognition of authority. And by the children recognizing authority and respecting authority, it's easy for anyone who is in authority to teach the child and discipline the child and make the child aware of the importance of living a life in accord with the law even after he grows up.
How did you happen to join the Muslim movement?
I was in prison. I was a very wayward, criminal, backward, illiterate, uneducated, and whatever other negative characteristics you can think of, type of person, until I heard the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And because of the impact that it had upon me in giving me a desire to reform myself and rehabilitate myself for the first time in my life, and also being able to see the effect that it had upon others, this is what made me accept it. And plus, prior to hearing what he teaches, I had no interest whatsoever in anything serious or any kind of educational pursuits. And I noticed that after being exposed to the religious teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, immediately it instilled within me such a high degree of racial pride and racial dignity that I wanted to be somebody. And I realized that I couldn't be anybody by begging the white man for what he had, but that I had to get out here and try and do something for myself or make something out of myself.
What has been the growth of the Muslim movement? There are conflicting reports as to how many Muslims there are in the United States. Can you tell us?
Well, most critics say that the dissatisfied follow Muhammad, that the unemployed and the oppressed follow Muhammad. And I think you'll agree, the sociologists, the economists, and other experts say that the masses of black people are dissatisfied, unemployed, oppressed, and fed up, so that he actually gets his support at the mass level. But now you have other Negroes at the class level who pretend not to go for him, because usually their job has been given to them by the white man. They have positions to which they have been appointed, and they think that the only way that they can protect their job is by pretending in front of the white man that they don't go for Mr. Muhammad either. But
how many Muslims do you say there are in numbers?
I couldn't say. I've never heard him say, and he's the only one who would know.
500,000?
I couldn't say. I think that anyone who does say is not in a position to know, and anyone who knows wouldn't say.
What do you think that the Urban League and the NAACP have accomplished for your people? What's your attitude?
Well, in their own way, they have been doing their best to bring about freedom, justice, and equality and human dignity for the black people in this country. But today you have such an intense degree of dissatisfaction and impatience existing among our people at the mass level that it is almost impossible to come to them with a program that's going to take another 100 years to solve their problem and they still be satisfied to wait. So that they have, the Urban League and the NAACP has done a good job within their understanding. But today it takes immediate solutions. And the solution that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has is immediate. It's more fast.
They're not moving fast enough.
Well, they're moving as fast as they can. But that's not fast enough for the masses of black people. If a person is sitting on a warm stove and you get ready to let him up, no matter how slow you are, he has patience because it's only warm. But the masses of black people who are sitting on a hot stove, they're impatient. And no matter how fast you say progress is being made toward letting them up, that progress is not fast enough for them.
Well, the NAACP and the Urban League have both been critical of the of the Muslim.
The NAACP and Urban League have been maneuvered into criticizing us against their own will. Usually, the divide and conquer tactics have always been used by the oppressor to keep the oppressed oppressed. And the NAACP has been used against the Muslims. Efforts have been made to use us against them. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said he'll work with the NAACP, the Urban League, and any other Negro organization that wants to uplift the black man as long as it doesn't conflict with our religious principles.
I remember once when Elijah was quoted as having said that the Urban League and the NAACP sold out to the white man. Has he ever made that statement to you?
To my knowledge, I don't think that he has said that they sold out to the white man. I've heard him say that.
That is stealing.
The NAACP has been in existence for 54 years. And they elect a new national president every year, and they have never elected a black man to sit in that capacity. Arthur Spingarn has been president of the NAACP for 24 years. And so in this sense, it means that either they're practicing the same discrimination that they accuse the white man of practicing, they're practicing it themselves, or else they're not qualifying other Negroes in that organization for the positions of leadership. This is our only criticism.
You personally feel that they have sold out to the white man? You personally feel that those organizations have sold out to the white man?
I don't think that they would knowingly allow themselves to be used or misused against their own people. So if they are failing to do the job that our people are expecting of them, probably it's just through lack of understanding. But today their understanding is increasing, and you'll find that they're developing a better ability to work with all different factions for the betterment of our people.
Malcolm, how do you yourself feel about the white man?
I believe that the white man has done a great injustice to the black man in this country by having kidnapped our people and brought us here and down to the level that we're on today. And today, instead of approaching the factors that their original mistake has created, instead of approaching these factors objectively and realistically, the greatest sin that they're doing now is trying to pretend that they never committed a crime, that they never did any wrong. And when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad points out the injustices that our people are suffering, they make that sin worse by accusing him of teaching hate, or by accusing him of black supremacy, or by accusing him of advocating violence, simply because he is pointing out the real factors in the problem.
We have a little time left. You don't have to hurry so much, Malcolm. You were born in Omaha, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And your family left Omaha when you were about 1 year old.
I imagine about a year old.
Now, why did they leave Omaha?
Well, to my understanding, the Ku Klux Klan burned down one of their homes in Omaha.
This made your family feel very unhappy, I'm sure.
Well, insecure, if not unhappy.
So you must have a somewhat prejudiced point of view, a personally prejudiced point of view. In other words, you cannot look at this in a broad, academic sort of way, really.
I think that's incorrect, because despite the fact that happened in Omaha, and then when we moved to Lansing, Michigan, our home was burned down again. In fact, my father was killed by the Ku Klux Klan. And despite all of that, no one was more thoroughly integrated with whites than I. No one had lived more so in the society of whites than I. And it was only until I became a Muslim that I ceased living in the society of whites.
You say you're thoroughly integrated with the whites.
Yes.
Do you have white people in your family background?
Definitely. Most Negroes in this country have whites in their family background.
How are you going to differentiate between the white blood that's in you and the Negro blood that's in you? And you don't mind my using
it. No.
You use this yourself?
I use it interchangeably.
I know you do. Why do you do that?
Well, I use it if it fits the purpose to use it, but I use it against my will.
You used it voluntarily in describing the incident in Los Angeles.
Still, I use it against my will.
I guess the teachings weren't thoroughly inculcated.
No, but when I say to you that the cops in Los Angeles shot down seven unarmed Negroes, every Negro in the audience knows what I'm talking about. But when I say that they shot seven Muslims, then a lot of the Negroes don't realize that they're still talking about
colored people, because you said you used the term colored people. You said
I don't think I used the word colored on this program.
Yes, you did.
Not colored.
I think so. Black people, I'm sorry.
Black. Well, we can use black, and that fits everything.
Okay.
But
now let me get back to another point that you made. You said that you go back home. Now, what do you mean by back home?
I've only heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad say, back among our own people. From
you
when
said
we,
back home. You
yes,
don't mind myself.
Right, back home. But by that,
you mean back into the roots of Islam, or do you mean back to Africa?
Back home. And by back home, he means back into our original civilization. And if you study history, the Islamic culture existed in West Africa.
But your family didn't come from an Islamic background originally, did it? I mean, you came from the proud tribes of Africa, which is
I think you'll find, sir, that one of that Islam, the Islamic culture, existed widely in Africa, Central Africa, West Africa.
I agree. I've met many people in there. Mr. O'Connor.
With regard to that tragedy out there in Los Angeles, I myself refer to it when it happened as the tragic police action, so I am not totally biased.
Thank you, sir.
Coming from Muhammad Speaks, which is the publication of your cult or your religion, Elijah Muhammad, referred to the policemen out there, the white policemen, as devils. He said, there is no justice here for us black people. There is no future for us nor our children in civilized America. Doesn't that imply that you're going to get out, or that's his wish that you get out?
And he referred to those policemen out there as devils who were heavily armed and knew that the men, the Negroes, whom they were shooting down in cold blood, were not heavily armed. I don't think that those policemen themselves would deny that they're devils, nor would any Negro who witnessed such a deed deny that they are devils.
Well, about the other part of it, there is no justice here for us black people. There is no future for us nor our children in civilized America. And I didn't make that up. He said it in his own...
And he's correct in what he says, sir.
Well, what does it mean? Does it mean you're going to get out?
It means the same thing that Attorney General Robert Kennedy means when he says that the number one domestic problem in America is the race problem. That it is almost impossible to solve it. It's almost impossible to give justice to Negroes.
One brief thing further. I read also in Muhammad Speaks the quotation that Elijah Muhammad is the only person on earth who is who was on personal speaking terms with God. Do you believe that?
Definitely.
You do?
Definitely.
We're going to have to leave it at that.
And Malcolm,
I'm sure he's done a good job of rehabilitating you. It was a pleasure to have you on, so he does.
I'm in Chicago for the next 3 weeks at the local mosque at 54th and Greenwood for a special lecture series.
That was something by Malcolm X. It's called City Desk, done in 1963. It gave you a clear understanding of how Malcolm felt, but more importantly, who he represented at that particular time felt. And I'm going to conclude the show by saying it, Malcolm and the black Muslims at that particular time saw quite a bit of things that, for some strange reason, black people were sort of afraid of joining with them. Because it seemed like it attacked their religious beliefs. So, and I don't even think that there are a large number of black people even today subscribe to many of the concepts and ideas that were suggested and projected at that particular time by Malcolm X. Great leader, great ideas, just going, they went too far. But at the same time, who knows, maybe not far enough. Things seem to change, however. Society has to be studied very closely by a backward movement. If we don't pay close attention, some leaders will put us back so far, we just might believe we are in slavery. In fact, some leaders felt we as a people should have never tried to become a part of a desegregated society. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good weekend, people, and stay safe. Thank you.